two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
JVD Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. And as promised, we are talking with Alicia Garr, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, but so much more. An incredible organizer who has receipts upon receipts. And I was joking with her because she has a new book that talks about power. And she is laying out all these receipts, not just about her work, but also about movements. And so when I say it's a lot more to her than just being a co-founder of Black Lives Matter, I really mean that. But Alicia, welcome to the show. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have been asking you questions because we couldn't get you on yesterday because everybody was hollering at you. You're from the city and county of San Francisco, which was home to a certain person named Kamala, who participated in the debate last night. You was an organizer in that city when she was the DA, and you was doing Black Lives Matter when she was the Attorney General. We want to know what the heck you were thinking at this debate last night. There has to be layers upon layers to pick apart.
There certainly are. I mean, I think we can start from the premise that she was excellent last night. This is really her arena. And besides the fact that we know that she was on the debate team in college, we also know that, you know, Kamala does not play no games. And she really, I think, took control of that debate last night. I think we learned who she was. I think we saw a woman who exhibited incredible poise in the face of a lot of nonsense that was thrown at her. And I also think that we saw, you know, just from my own perspective, I think we saw a really important glimpse of what women in general and Black women specifically experience every day of our lives, being talked over, being talked at, being talked about, people talking bad on our name, right? And having to exhibit that kind of incredible poise and control and also get you together. So I think that's what we saw. I mean, I'll be honest, there were things that just topic-wise, I thought needed addressing and needed to be addressed in a broader and more deep way. But in general, if I were to talk about how I thought her performance was last night, I think it was excellent. I also noticed that it did feel to me like there were some places where actually she was to the left of Joe Biden. And she, you know, Mike Pence tried it in the sense of, you know, trying to comfort her around, you know, their positions on environmental justice and, you know, tried to make her out to be some like radical leftist, which she is not. But I think we've also seen that before. We saw that when she was district attorney in San Francisco, where the police unions literally tried to make her out like she was, you know, Bobby Seale or Huey Newton or something. And she was not. And so, you know, I think we saw some interesting things on display last night. But in general, I thought that Senator Harris really, really earned her slot. And she showed that she would be a formidable vice president.
Let me ask you this, and this is the reason why. Nationally, she has been pummeled with a number of criticisms. You know, primarily she locked up black men, she threw away the key, et cetera, et cetera. And there can be some examples that you can look at, but really the rub for her, as far as I remember, and I mean, if you just look at the article, most of the real rub was that she didn't prosecute killer cops, Mario Woods, Andy Lopez, you know, the list kind of goes on, either as DA or attorney general. So I was kind of surprised to hear when she took this position about, you know, police reform. But with that being said, how do you address, you know, that criticism, you know, or how do you think that criticism of her locking up black men disproportionately needs to be looked at? Because that's been a sticking stone, especially once you leave the Bay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we need to look at it in its fullness. And, you know, I will be honest and say, I personally think that what we've been missing this entire election season, both when Senator Harris was running for president herself, and then, of course, also in this process of her being the vice presidential running mate to presidential nominee Joe Biden, is that we haven't really had a candid conversation about her record with her. Lots of people have tried to shape her record according to their own political agenda. I think we saw it last night, you know, Mike Pence and the Trump administration, who has no record to stand on in relationship to, you know, lowering the rates of mass incarceration, dismantling the disproportionate ways in which Black and Brown communities are incarcerated and criminalized in our communities. The Trump administration has no foundation to stand on, and I don't count the First Step Act as anything for them to stand on. And in fact, if we're to keep it 100, they only trot out the First Step Act when they want to push back against assertions and claims that they are racist and that they support white nationalism and white supremacy. But they don't, as a matter of principle or practice, do anything substantive for Black communities, especially in relationship to criminal justice reform. So with that being said, I have said for a long time that I think the thing we've been missing from these campaign conversations and debates is a conversation with Senator Harris about her perspective on her own record, her perspective on where she could have done better and should have done better, and her perspective on where she will and has done better. And the reason that I bring this up is because what I know is that there is a very detrimental and widespread campaign of misinformation and disinformation. And a lot of it has centered around her. I think the reason that it's so hard to pull apart what her record actually is not only because she's not spoken on it herself, but because the room that has left has allowed a lot of other unsavory forces to get inside of that gap and shape that story on her behalf. And I don't agree with that. I think that at the end of the day, she has a lot of things to account for, and she has a lot of things to be proud of. And I think where we have to be very careful, especially as it relates to Black voters, is this notion that we have to be careful in the sense that Black voters are being targeted for voter suppression, and misinformation and disinformation is a core voter suppression tactic. I can say that her alleged record is a topic of conversation amongst Black male voters who are ages, you know, 18 to 40. But it's not a problem that her record is a topic of conversation amongst these voters. The problem is the messages that they are using. Now, the reality is, right, that there are highs and lows to every prosecutor's record. And part of that has to do with the fact that they're prosecutors. They work on behalf of the state and to move a particular agenda. you know, for the families, of course, of people like Mario Woods and others, I mean, there certainly should be and must be scrutiny here. I mean, there are real people who are at stake. There are real people's lives who have been impacted by decisions that either she has made or people have made on her behalf. And at the same time, I think it's important that Black voters be energized by truthful and factual information. That doesn't mean we don't hold people accountable for what they've done, but we've got to actually get clear on what they've done. Let me say one more thing in this respect and in this regard. You know, when we look at this administration's record, not just on criminal justice reform, but racial justice, I said earlier that they have no record to stand on, and I want to correct that. The record that they have to stand on is one of white nationalism and white supremacy. We have seen how this administration has attacked Black Lives Matter and this movement, attempting to frame our movement and the people inside of it as terrorists. We have seen the ways in which this administration has openly supported white nationalists and white supremacists. And in fact, just a week ago, the President of the United States, when questioned about the Proud Boys, literally said, "Proud Boys, stand back and stand by." Right. So, you know, I think we have to get really clear here about what's at stake. And frankly, there's a lot on the table, and anything we leave on the table, we're leaving for someone else to eat. Yeah. Someone like Kamala Harris needs to be pushed on her record. And the threat that we are facing in our communities is not people like Kamala Harris. The threat we're facing in our communities across the board, from the economy to democracy to our society, is people like Donald Trump and Mike Pence and the folks that surround them who are making rules as we speak about us without us.
You know, we're talking with Alicia Garza, if you're just tuning in, and you have a book. I don't know if it's officially out because I got an advance of it.
don't be bragging, Davey.
No, but I mean, you know, because I don't want to be like, you know, be like, it don't come out till next year. But
the purpose out in like 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Yeah, okay. Okay. So it still isn't out. Okay. The purpose of power. In your book, you lay down, you go through a history lesson that I think when people get this book, they need to read those first two chapters, because you talk about movements and we're thinking like, oh, it's going to talk about Dr. King and Black Panthers. And it's like you did a whole history lesson on the conservative movement, which was just remarkable, you know, very detailed, very graphic and, you know, riveting. And also disturbing. And I bring this up because within those movements, we know that we've seen COINTELPRO, we've seen the disinformation campaigns, and we've seen the demonization and criminalization of Black folks and Black movements. Here you are, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. And this movement has been bantered about in the same words as terrorism, has been bantered about as being subversive. And you talked about laws. You had an attorney general right now, William Barr, looking at BLM and trying to come up with some sort of arcane rules, which you actually talk about or allude to in the book, you know, at the time that it happened in the 1800s, where they're like, yo, you know, let's see if we can get these folks on some sort of sedition charges. So there's a few questions I want to bring up. First, being front and center of this arc where an organization or a movement that you've been integral in is looking at, you know, the words terrorism being attached to it. And, you know, in words like treason and sedition and decades in jail and all these other things, what goes on through your mind and how are you parsing that out at this point? And what do we need to know in the larger picture at hand? Because you're not a spectator in this sort of situation. Mm-hmm. You don't have to, what's the word? You don't have to, you know, give, I'm losing my train of thought. You're living it. This is you.
Yep. I mean, look, if nothing else, I hope that what we're able to take from this moment is that the stakes are high. And, you know, you're absolutely right. It's surreal to be in the center of this moment and be used as a political football for an agenda that is not your own. And I think that, you know, some of us may have the tendency sometimes to not take this administration seriously in terms of their threats or in terms of their belief systems. And I think what we have to remember is that they are wildly organized around their belief systems, and they are deeply organized around these systems. They are planning and excited to ensure that they can make an intervention in the success of this global movement. And they have no qualms about targeting any of us who say that we have any affinity or affiliation with this movement. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember when a couple of years ago, you know, in response to, you know, Bill Barr and actually it was prior to Bill Barr, I believe it was Attorney General Jeff Sessions, you know, when they started to kind of roll out these terms like Black identity extremists. And some of us, right, some of us went so far as to make T-shirts that said, I'm a Black identity extremist. And, you know, part of what's wrong with that is that it represents a lack of understanding of history. And if, as you know, if we fail to learn the lessons of the past, we are doomed to repeat them in the future. The lessons of the past are this. What we know is that a government, when run by the wrong people, will stop at nothing to intervene against anything that threatens to derail their power. And what we know is that there were entire government programs that were designed, developed, and implemented to stop these movements. And if we think for 1 minute that this Black identity extremist thing won't reemerge, if we think for 1 minute that Bill Barr is as the latest attorney general, if he's allowed to stay in power, if we don't think that he is going to not just convene task forces, but start jailing people, then we are delusional. I think we saw this in Portland, right? Where literally they killed somebody extrajudicially and bragged about it, who they believed was a member of quote unquote Antifa, which we all know is an ideology. It is not itself an organization. So literally what they did was they killed somebody who was an anti-fascist. You know, and nobody blinked an eye. I think we have to be very, very mindful and aware and diligent about fighting back against these kinds of attacks, because the fact of the matter is, anybody who thinks that it's somebody else's problem will quickly find out that it's your problem too.
You know, one of the things with that debate is that, as it was pointed out by Kamala about George Floyd and about Breonna Taylor and the horrors of their death, it was immediately countered with, well, you know, they broke in some windows and they stole some stuff. And now those became the equivalents. Your thoughts on that? You know, it kind of gives a different meaning to Black Lives Matter to me. It's like, wow, you're talking about broken windows versus somebody from the state who put 8 minutes of pressure on a man and killed him. And one of the things I like about your book, you remind people of the brutality, which was very similar to George Floyd, that Oscar Grant went through. You know, it's crazy. And you know, they just opened up the case, or they're pushing to open up the case around Tony Peroni. And there I am reading your thing, and it's like, oh snap, she's talking about Tony Peroni and that brutality. But your thoughts on just that alone, you know, this narrative and BLM's name being tossed in the mix for broken windows, yeah, and fires in the streets.
Yeah. Well, I guess my thoughts on it, frankly, are that these are all distraction tactics. I mean, look at what happens and look at where we got to. So, you know, the way that we got to this place, quite frankly, is that these protests and this movement had an explosion this summer. Because of the murders of people like Ahmaud Arbery, because of the murders of people like George Floyd and Tony McDade and Breonna Taylor, this movement had another renaissance and another awakening. And this movement quickly spread, not just across the United States, but globally. And because of that, right, Black Lives Matter is now widely known to be the largest protest movement in history. And that it's right at that time when we start to see and hear these different kinds of tropes. They are all designed to distract and to delegitimize this movement. All of a sudden, we start to hear all of these things about rioting and looting. But here's the catch. The catch of this is, and Vice just did a really good story on this a couple of weeks ago. Here's the facts. The facts of the matter are 96%, according to Vice News, of what they call Black Lives Matter protests have been largely peaceful, meaning no property destruction, no violence, no looting, no rioting. And in that 4% where there was something like this, what Vice News named was that the violence was actually a result of white militia groups and white terror. And so, you know, part of what we see here, and we've been slamming the Biden campaign around this as well, is that, you know, nobody's really talking about the fact that there are white men with guns that are walking around with no consequences, and that they are shooting protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that they are showing up in force to intimidate and to break windows and to create property destruction in Minnesota. And, you know, we've even seen it here in the Bay Area, where a federal agent was killed during a protest in downtown Oakland. And they were very quick to say, oh, Black Lives Matter. But then we come to find out that a couple of weeks later, a man was apprehended. Well, I believe he was actually shot and killed, if I'm not mistaken. And he was a member of the Boogaloo Boys, which is a white supremacist organization. And so we have to understand that these are COINTELPRO-like tactics, but remastered for the 2020 age. And it is easy for people to fall into these traps of misinformation and disinformation. You know, if you talk about Black Lives Matter today, the first thing people will talk about is rioting and looting, even if they've been to a Black Lives Matter protest and didn't experience that for themselves. That's the era that we're living in, that lies spread faster and farther than the truth. And that has a lot to do with platforms like Facebook that don't do enough, right, to monitor the spread of misinformation and disinformation on their platforms. In fact, they don't do a lot, if I'm being 100% honest. And so, you know, I mean, from Kamala Harris to Black Lives Matter, I think we have to understand that there is a parallel campaign to discredit and delegitimize things that are and people who are appealing to the majority of Americans. And if we don't learn this lesson, as I said earlier, we are doomed to be advancing someone else's agenda that is not ours. Now, again, people can have legitimate critiques of Black Lives Matter, and you can have legitimate critiques of Kamala Harris. I'm not going to rob you of those. And in fact, turn up the volume. But make sure what you're turning up the volume on is actually facts and not opinions, but also not messages that are strategically designed to dismantle, discredit, and delegitimize these movements that, frankly, are fighting for our lives.
You talked about messaging in your book, and you know how the right is part of their strategy with Reagan in particular, to come up with euphemisms to really describe things in such a way that they dog whistle. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you see that playing out? One thing that I really came away, you know, just in looking at this, is very clear that this current administration is a direct continuum of what was started 40 years ago. It may not seem like it on the surface, but I'm like, damn, this is the same thing, just a different name, a different turn up. But I was like, did I draw the wrong conclusion? Is that how you see it, or did I miss something?
No, you haven't missed anything. I mean, I think what we have to understand is that there isn't really much that's new under the sun. And what I say in my book is I use Frantz Fanon and his quote about the mission of each generation, right? And the choice that each generation has to fulfill or betray that mission. And I think Black Lives Matter is no different. I think that certainly we are a tributary of a long river that came before us that has been fighting for the rights and dignity and livelihood of Black people ever since we were brought here at the bottom of boats in chains. And I think that, you know, what we have to deeply understand about the history of this deeply racist nation is that even though formalized enslavement is no longer legal, what was put in its place were mechanisms to keep Black people out and keep Black people behind. And that's true from Jim Crow to segregation to the attacks on affirmative action, right? I mean, over and over again, what we see is a reimagining of the mm-hmm. kinds of rules and policies that can keep Black communities without power. And when we talk about messaging, one of the things that's really important here is that messaging is really about shaping culture, and it's about shaping worldview and ideas. Mm-hmm. And it is the reason, right, that we believe things like, if you work hard, you can get ahead. It's the reason that we say things like, you know, America is a nation of immigrants. It is the reason that we say things like, you know, people who get killed by the police, they must have done something to deserve it. These are all the results of messages. And sometimes these messages are what we call dog whistles. Dog whistle racism is a term that was coined and popularized by Ian Haney Lopez. And it basically talks about how there are messages that can essentially imply a thing without ever saying it. Mm-hmm. The person who was an incredible messenger and using dog whistle racism is Ronald Reagan, who was the former governor of California and then, of course, was president of the United States for two terms. And Ronald Reagan was excellent, excellent at painting a picture of who it is that you should fear, painting a picture of who it is that you should distrust, painting a picture of who it is that was gaming the system without ever, ever, ever explicitly saying Black people are bad.
Yeah.
And so I think we have to, and this isn't just about Black people. I mean, this is about everyone who's been categorized in such a way as an other. So that could be Latinx people, that could be Asian folks, right? From the Asian diaspora. And of course we see, you know, these messages today are no longer dog whistles, they're bullhorns. Yeah. We saw on the stage last night, Mike Pence throwing in comments about communist China. Ain't nobody was talking about China, but here come Mike Pence talking about communist China. And you know, I think what's real is that the dog whistles or the bullhorns, if you will, of today are those about Antifa and BLM and communist China and the radical left that is trying to disrupt our way of life. And these tactics have been used for time immemorial, from Bull Connor's speech that he gave about outsiders coming in and trying to disrupt, folks' way of life in Alabama. We saw a Black man, Daniel Cameron, who's the attorney general for Kentucky, give that same speech, except it didn't come from white people, it came from a Black man. So there's a lot of nuance here, but the point of it is we have to be very mindful of whose stories we're telling and what impact those stories have on our everyday lives.
Right, and you know, we're gonna have to have you come back when the book is out, because you cover a lot of this, you know. You talk about the Black faces, talk about, you know, the folks who were paid to actually do this, all this sort of stuff. But you know, the issue at hand is this debate and it's the trajectory that's leading us to this election. And so as we close out, Alicia Garza, what do you see coming down the pipe and what do you think people need to be doing?
Well, I mean, coming down the pike, obviously, is we're in the middle of an election season. And I say election season because I think we should all get socialized to the fact that, this election is not going to be called on Election Day, given all of the crises that we faced around the U.S. Postal Service, a crisis created by Donald Trump, given the crisis of the pandemic, another crisis exacerbated by Donald Trump and Mike Pence. And also just given the crisis of what's happening in our economy, nothing is going to be decided immediately. And so it creates the conditions for, you know, for a coup to happen. And I know there's a lot more conversation about this now, where Donald Trump has literally said that he does not plan to honor the results of the election. And he's trying to cast doubt on the integrity and validity of our voting systems. So I think we should be prepared for that. I think we should be prepared for Donald Trump to claim victory when we actually don't know what the mandate of the people is. I think we should be prepared for this administration to continue to try and attack Black Lives Matter, Antifa, and others who dare, right, to challenge their agenda and dare to challenge their narrative. But I also think that we need to be prepared for what it means if we are successful in 2020, and if we are able to vote in the kinds of numbers that indicate a mandate for change. You know, one of the things that I think is important is, of course, that we always prepare for the disaster scenarios. And frankly, every single one of us should be making a safety plan. That's just a fact.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think we also have to be prepared for the possibility that if the Biden-Harris ticket wins and we are able to usher Donald Trump out of the White House in handcuffs like he should be, then what? Do we go back to a pre-pandemic normal, which was not actually great for us? Or are we going to be prepared to usher in a completely new era of change? And certainly that era will have its own challenges. But I think we've got enough experience under our belts now that I hope we're prepared to make new mistakes as opposed to making the same ones over and over again.
Real talk. And, you know, I appreciate that. Sound advice and you know, as they say, it's going to be more than just voting that we need to be doing, you know.
Facts on facts.
You know, it's just like, it's more than just getting a gun. if you're going to be engaged in a war, you're going to have strategy. You got to have a plan for where you get your ammunition, you know.
That's right.
You got to have a plan to get more guns, all this sort of stuff. And the same thing with this vote. The vote is just one of many steps. But look, I appreciate you coming on this afternoon and sharing your thoughts.
Well, thanks for having me.
And we're going to have you come back to talk about this book, you know, Purpose of Power, because that's a whole other thing. I mean, we kind of alluded to it, but you did your thing. I'm just going to say that right off the bat. You went to the woodshed and came back and was like, here, now what? You know, so.
Well, I figured if we were going to write a 300-page book, put something in there that people can get down with.
No, there's a lot to get down with. So we're just going to have you come and do a whole, just a book with Alicia Garza talking about it. Just to kind of give people, wet their tongues a little. You have a whole chapter on voting can be a movement. You know, you have a whole chapter on the power of identity politics. You have a whole thing on Ferguson, right? Which is a whole thing in itself. You're talking about what was going on here in San Francisco. So a lot of history, you know, we live in a moment, so we forget it's been 20 years since 2000.
That's right.
It's 30 years since the 90s. And you cover a lot of that ground of what was going on. Organizations like Soul and Power and Oscar Grant, it's like a lot of stuff in there. So, yeah, you know, props to you on that. So I'm going to say
that
first.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And you bring up a lot of figures, you know, a lot of names
in
there.
You know, we did our thing.
Yes, you did.
We did our thing. I tried to capture and document my experiences and my perspective. And honestly, what I hope comes out of this book is that other people document theirs. I mean, we need to keep this history alive, and certainly it should live through us. But what happens if we're not here to tell the story? We have to leave our records behind. And you know, I'm hoping that this can be a catalyst for a whole canon of experiences and perspectives from this moment, because there's a lot of jewels here that are worth exploring and also learning from.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break. We've been talking with Alicia Garza. We're here on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.